Session number 12268, Mr. Charles Bedimin, Reel 1.
And this is Charles Bedimin, Reel 1. And so if I could ask you, first of all, Charles, you know, a little bit about your background before the war started.
Right. The, well, I was 26 years old when the war started. So, in effect, I'd been through two world wars, although I was obviously an infant when the First War started, because I was born in 1913.
Did you have any memory, you know, interrupting your flow?
Of the First War?
Yes.
My memory of the First World War really is in one episode when I was taken by my mother to a shelter. There was a Zeppelin raid, and this was towards the end of the war, so I was probably something like 4 years old, and my mother was carrying my young sister, who was 2 years younger than myself, and we were hurrying to a shelter, which I think was a warehouse system. And I remember quite vividly seeing a Zeppelin in the sky, lit up by searchlights. And of course, to a little boy, the whole thing was quite frightening, and I suppose it impressed itself on my memory. And in this large warehouse system, there were railway lines, because they obviously ran trucks in there. And I can remember, so many hundreds of people staying there during the night until the particular raids had finished. So that's my, well, not quite my only memory of the war, because I can remember going to school, probably was an infant school, and seeing sandbags around the windows. But those are my only memories of the First World War. I was average sort of boy, I suppose. I was athletic, and liked all sports, and was quite reasonably studious. We came to Clacton when I was 15 years old, because my father's health hadn't been too good, and he was a master hairdresser. And I suppose that began my association with hair and skin, because I grew up in this sort of atmosphere. I studied before the war, and indeed had passed my final examination as a trichologist just after the war had started. I joined the local territorials mainly because I was impatient. I really wanted to go into the Navy, because I do have quite a love of the sea. But when I inquired, they told me that I ought to come back in about 9 months' time to a year. And that seemed too long to me to wait. Most of my friends were joining a local territorial battery which was being formed. This was Light ACAC, and so in company with a lot of the young men of the district, I joined. And really was quite happy with it, I suppose mainly because we were friends, and there were one or two anomalies, like the major was a local poultry farmer, quite a keen cricketer, and
one of my friends was a Lance Bombardier named Arnold Quick, who played for Essex and captained the local team. So we always used to pull his leg and tell him that the Major stood to attention when he spoke to him because of his prowess as a cricketer and the fact that he was his team captain.
Did you have any idea that a war was pending when you went into the territorials?
Oh yes. And it seemed to me that there was really no choice, because it was obviously there was going to be no life under Hitler. I think we all felt this, and this is what it ought to be. We had a very short period of training, something like a month, I suppose. And as I said, after I joined the territorials, my final qualification came through. I then felt that it probably would have been more sensible for me to have joined the medical corps. But at that stage, ACAC gunners were quite important people, and they weren't prepared to transfer anybody. So I settled down to my life as a gunner. We mainly moved around Anglia, had quite a pleasant time in Chelmsford on the guarding the factories of Marconi and Hoffman. Hoffman were people who made ball bearings and were important to the war effort. It was pleasant because all we had was Lewis guns, and they were useless at night, so they were packed up and we could just go out on the town. After a while we moved to Malsham, and that became more interesting. You don't want me to go into a lot of details, do you, of my territory? Right. Eventually, after the Battle of after Dunkirk, we were equipped with Bofors. They were light ACAC guns, fine guns too, and still being used to this day, and that's 50 years later. I don't doubt that they're modified in all sorts of ways, but basically a very good gun that could, even in those days, could fire two shells a second. It was of interest to Marsham because this was a hurricane squadron, and although very much is made of Spitfires during the war, the hurricanes themselves did play a tremendous part, and we were fortunate to train with ace pilots like Killer Tuck and Sailor Mallon. They were training too because they were doing low-level attacks on French airfields, and we had the advantage of being able to have them whizzing over us at 400 miles an hour at very low level. In retrospect, I think we were quite a fine regiment, and a large proportion of our battery were commissioned and into all sorts of fields. And this went on until in 1940 there was a request for volunteers to man guns on shipping, because we were losing ships at the rate of knots. And because of my desire to be at sea, I volunteered. I then become a troop sergeant major, and had also become a divisional instructor in gunnery. I'm no engineer, but I tend to be enthusiastic once I have any particular job to do, and studied the guns, and have been mathematically minded, so that a little bit to my surprise, I did become a division instructor, which meant that once I was commissioned, you could skip sort of minor commissioned ranks. Having volunteered to serve with the Merchant Navy, I then went home on leave, and my mother was a bit tearful because my brother, who was in the Air Force, was going off somewhere overseas. In actual fact, he finished his war very comfortably in Egypt and Kenya. So I didn't say anything to her at all about my volunteer for service out in the Atlantic. Came back, and the OC sent for me and said that as I'd volunteered, that had top priority, but he asked me to reconsider on a couple of counts: A, because he rather wanted me to stay with him, and B, because he thought that I was rather thwarting any promotion prospects I might have. And so on the basis that my brother was going abroad and this was enough for my mother's stand, I decided to stay. As it turned out, it probably wasn't a brilliant decision, because within a relatively short space of time I became a prisoner of the Japanese. We achieved a new colonel. We had been commanded by a major, McCartney Fieldgate, and he had become a colonel. He was a fine man and had, or was, one of the three directors of Singer and Freelander, who are great international merchant bank. He was replaced by a colonel, do I give a name? By Colonel Pearson, who was a regular cavalryman. I found in my service career that I could respect ability and had some difficulty in just respecting rank as such. I didn't see very much of this Colonel Pearson, but he was a blimpish type, and insisted that we had stables every morning at 11 o'clock, because this was his life, and he was a conservative type of individual who wasn't going to change very much.
What do you mean by stables?
In the cavalry, it's one of their inspections. So they have this sounded on the bugles, and then everybody has to stand to for inspection of stables. Actually, I'm quite a keen horseman, and I'd have been happy to have been in the cavalry. But by the time I joined the army, the horses were disappearing, and we were just a highly mechanized section of the Royal Artillery. Territorial service was a great deal of interest, and I still feel that it's traditional and almost the backbone of this country.
What do you think is the difference between the territorials and the regular army? Would you say, are there any sort of advantages?
Well, the territorials were local and parochial. They were volunteers, whereas a lot of people join the regular army, as far as the ranks are concerned, they join very often because they have to, in the sense that there wasn't very much else they could do. There was a deal of unemployment between the two wars, so that men who felt they wanted some sort of career would join the services. And as far as the officers were concerned, they tended then just to be a particular sector of society. Could be good and efficient, but weren't always particularly intellectual. Whereas territorials, particularly in a war situation, were took in good types. The types who like the idea of a service life, but in the main had been well educated. And the Territorial Army has always provided a great deal of its commissioned officers from their ranks. And indeed, you've got some specialised territorial regiments like the Honourable Artillery Company or the Artists Rifles or City of London Rifles, etc., who were virtually there to provide initial officer training. So, I quite liked the army life. I mean, you obviously had some types who weren't particularly intelligent or pleasant, but generally speaking, were with friends and local people. So you had this very strong parochial feeling.
Right. So could I ask you now about your journey to the Far East? You know, first of all, did you have special trip? Were you told where you were going? Would you have been given any idea?
Yes. We knew we were going to Singapore.
What were your expectations, being told you were going to Singapore? Because this would have been presumably before Japan entered the war. Am I right in thinking that?
Yes. Well, I think with most of us, we were reasonably excited about it, because this was travelling to faraway places, and we were basically a well-trained regiment, and the soldier's job really is to fight. And particularly with territorials, you volunteered for that purpose. So that in a sense, you're almost looking forward to utilising your guns and equipment and training.
Did you know anything about Japan and the Japanese? You know, did you?
No, I knew nothing at all about the Japanese, and I can remember thinking to myself when I landed in Batavia that if anybody had asked me where Batavia was, I would have known it was in the Pacific, but I would have thought of it as an island. And I thought how wrong it was that these world events were taking place and that I personally had no knowledge at all of the Far East. But it was going to influence my life enormously. So this was a part of education that I hadn't received.
Did you at the time feel that Japan might come into the war? You know, was there any sort of common sort of
yes, there was a very strong inclination that Japan was going to come into the war, because her ties with Germany seemed very strong. In actual fact, there was a section in Japan
of the hierarchy who were against coming into the war, and they were pushed into war by the Americans. There's no doubt about this. This has been well documented. And later on, I met a Colonel Baldwin, who had been a military attaché, and he verified this. The American thinking was that the Japanese were becoming too strong an element in the Pacific, and they were very strongly entrenched on the Pacific coast of America.
No, it's just, you know, I wondered how you yourself, the knowledge you had of Japan at that time, and was there any particular perception, would you say, of the Japanese? Did you, for instance, respect them in the same way as perhaps the Germans might have been?
No. We really had no knowledge at all of the Japanese. And later on, I'll tell you some of the aspects of training they gave us, which I thought was quite stupid. So that we had a period of about 3 months in Southend before we embarked, and really our training did not encompass the tropics at all. So when we met up with tropical conditions and jungle warfare, we were virtually untrained. Maybe the training had been planned once we arrived in the area. We embarked at Gourock in December, and this was December the 13th.
Was that 1941?
I think so, yes. And my own regiment was on a liner called the Empress of India. This held about 3,000 men. I was ensconced with three other sergeant majors in a cabin, so we were reasonably comfortable. But that night, the men in the holds, and there were several decks to this large liner, virtually mutinied, because somehow they learnt that the last convoy to South Africa had lost every ship. And our convoy was to be a 17-knot convoy, which meant they was going to proceed at 17 knots, and if any ship for any reason whatsoever couldn't keep up, they were just simply left behind. Well, the men below realised that if anything happened, if a torpedo hit the ship, I mean, they would just drown like rats. So we were called from the mess at something like 10 o'clock at night, and all the officers and senior NCOs were called together to help control this mass exodus. The men just poured off the ship, and I saw one youngish lieutenant pull a revolver out, and somebody, possibly a gunner, knocked it, very sensibly knocked it out of his hand. They just went onto the dockside and milled around. The brigadiers in charge of the port talked to them sensibly, got them back on board ship and promised that this was going to be attended to, their complaints, and they would do whatever they could to make them comfortable. In actual fact, all that happened was once overboard, the ships set sail and just went out into the middle of the harbour, where obviously, I mean, they were there and the convoy could set off as it did. Their fears really were justified because a naval friend of mine told me that these coal-burning liners were visible for 100 miles with the plumes of smoke. However, off we went into the Atlantic. They sailed out into the Atlantic for 3 days, mainly to miss the submarines. And we were escorted by the Ramillies, which was a fine battleship, and several cruisers and odd corvettes. Once we passed Gibraltar, the weather changed, and we get into tropical kit. Before that, with all the bad weather, there was only a few of us who were able to get into the mess, and we thought this was almost like heaven because we had been in wartime Britain with its rations, and just any amount of food was available because there was just a few of us having the food which would normally have been shared by many hundreds. After Gibraltar, the weather calmed down and we got into normal conditions. The only submarine scare we had was outside Freetown, where the Navy did go into action, and we could see plumes of water coming up, probably with depth charges, and heard some action. On the Empress of India, we had one scare. We hit a storm, and the condensers on the ship went, and the speed was reduced to just a few knots per hour. This affected the steerage, and the ship took quite a hard battering with the storm, because with all boats, if you're in heavy storm conditions, the bows should face right into the waves. And once you lose your steerage way, then you're really going to be knocked around. Well, this meant that we took one or two heavy seas, scared people aboard because they thought we'd been hit by a torpedo. But after a time, this settled down and we had no further trouble until we got to Durban in South Africa.